You're listening to one in a series of podcasts from the 2009 High Ed Web Conference in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Thanks a lot. Okay. Well, thank you. Can everybody hear me okay in the back there? Good. Trust me, if you take a poll back there, if you want to set any bets on me tripping over any of this stuff, feel free to, okay? We got lots of wires here. This session is going to be a little different than probably most that you're going to be attending. I'm going to move this over here. So you're not going to talk solely about technology. This session's a little different. I've been talking about this subject for a couple of years now because it seems like it is appropriate for all areas of the institution. And as we're dealing with change throughout our organization, both certainly because of the economy, we can all talk about that. We'll try and skip over that today. I'm sure you've heard enough about the economic challenges your institutions may have, but also about technology and about management and leadership, costs, staffing, training, all those wonderful issues. So today's topic is about managing change. I will tell you, it is not a plug because I'm not selling it, so I'm giving it out back there. In the back of the room, if you leave, if you want to grab a copy of Chapter 2 of a book that we're writing called Overthrowing Dead Culture, we published the Chapter 2 called The Change. Everybody asked me, why didn't you publish Chapter 1? Well, we weren't done Chapter 1 yet, so I figured Chapter 2 would be the best one to, you know, publish the one that's done. So Chapter 2 is called The Change. So it summarizes some of the things we're talking about here today. So feel free to grab a copy. I don't remember how many I brought, but hopefully there's enough for all of you that are interested. We'll have the full book out in February, so if you're interested in checking that out later on. So really what I want to do is talk about change. I want to talk about how you manage change in your institution and how do you deal with that and what are some of the barriers to change that are going on. But first, let's just sort of open it up for a conversation on a Monday morning this early. Hopefully you've all had your coffee and are awake enough. Let's just talk about what is change like at your organization? What are you trying to change? What has to change at your organization? And what are the roadblocks to some of that happening for progress at your institution? What are you dealing with? Okay, be more specific.
I think you have organizational structures that are set to work a certain way, and it's difficult to divert how that structure works.
Okay.
And then also people that have to approve it.
Sure. What institution?
Duke.
Okay. Okay, of course. Of course not. Hey, we understand. All of you have ideas, and these have nothing to do with your own institution. So, Rachel.
I've been there 20, 30 years.
Yeah. Does anybody run into lifers that actually are willing to change? That embrace change? Yeah.
Yeah.
You have problems with the new ones, really? Okay. So the folks who don't know well enough that things are different. Okay. Others in the back. Yeah. Okay. I was going to tell the story about Carol Prosperi, my secretary at LaSalle University when I worked there for about 8 years. I walked in the door, it was 1993 or 1992 or so, and sat down my first day right across from her desk and said, Carol, so tell me about yourself. Tell me, you know, what goes on here. Here I'm the director of the MBA program. She had been there for at least 15, 18 years before then, had seen lots of people come and go. And she looked at me and says, well, Mr. Niles, we started out that way. We quickly changed that. I just one thing I have to tell you is I just don't like change. Oh, great. So I'm the poster child for change in her life right now, and she's telling me this. So we got along great, by the way. What else? Yeah.
Disintegrating budgets.
Okay. Okay. Disintegrating budgets. How to do more with less, right? You hear that all the time?
Yes. How to do same work with 10% less money,
yeah.
Less time, less pay.
Yeah. I'm glad you said the same work, because that whole more or less thing always bugs me. It's either, why do we always have to do more? Sometimes there's you can actually do less with less.
That's always.
But no, picking which ask you to do that, right? What else? Yes, in the back.
Our business model based on efficiency centered.
Very good. I like that. Very true. Yes.
I guess decentralization.
Okay. Yeah, which institution? Iowa State, okay. Yeah, it depends on the institution. I've seen small institutions have a hard time with that as well. I've seen that whole graduate. How many of you oversee graduate or work with your graduate programs? Yeah, I mean, graduate programs are either centralized, decentralized, or some mix of all of that. None of them seem to work, but we all try and get along, right? What else? Yes? Yes, got to pay a consultant. It's amazing. We spend all this time and money, search committees. I'll tell you about committees in a few minutes. Search committees to hire these fantastic people, pay you extraordinary salaries, right? That was a joke, okay. Unless you all are making extraordinary salaries, I'm getting out of my business. And that's right. But you're asked to do 10% less, right? No. And then they hire a consultant. It's amazing, isn't it? Amazing we do that. Anybody else? Okay. These are all good. So we got everybody in the same mindset. Everybody having a great time with change? Anybody want to tell a great story about, well, I had this miraculous idea and I actually got the institution to move forward with it?
Only when they didn't
know it. Okay, good. Well, that's okay. Hey, what they don't know won't kill them. What's something like that? Okay. Anybody have any good stories? Come on, it's time to brag. I succeeded with change. No. Nice. Now, why didn't you do that while you're working there? Okay. It wasn't a fear of being fired. I know you look it up. Okay. Couple of them you brought up. First one's fear of the unknown. When somebody comes in, particularly when a new person comes in, there's always this, oh, here comes somebody and they know better than I do, right? They know everything, so they're willing to change it. I must have been doing everything wrong. So sometimes we have a fear of the unknown. What's going to happen here? Or we've been trained to do something, and we've gotten comfortable with it. We actually get very comfortable in our positions very quickly. Who wants to have change? That was Carol. Who wants to have change? I'm very comfortable where I am. I come in the morning at 8 o'clock, and I leave at 4, and I do my job, and I go home. But I think, you know, business has changed from that model as well. I found this great cartoon. Hopefully you can see this. When asked, would you rather work for change or just complain? 81% of the response. Do I have to pick? This is hard. Change is hard. Was it Lewis Black that said the reason that we haven't fixed global warming and haven't come up with new energy alternatives is because it's hard? You know. I won't go on. It was offensive after that. The second part is loss of control. Losing control. We are very comfortable. We know what we know, right? The devil we know is better than the devil we don't. Anybody heard that phrase before? It's one of my favorites. I prefer to find the other devil, by the way. But loss of control, so used to the way it has been that we don't want to lose control of that. And we're moving up. We have our own personal objectives and we have our own professional objectives. And losing control may disrupt those. I'll tell you a story about, some of you may know, we offer a CRM solution. I'm just going to trip over this one. I'm just going to move this one too. By the time we're done, I'm going to have all the chairs all moved up to the front left of the room. TargetX offers a CRM on Salesforce, so it's in the cloud. Okay, you all know about cloud computing. Don't have to talk about that. We had an RFP that we submitted to an institution. We went all the way down the floor. Never said anything about that it had to be hosted on campus until we got there, and the VP of information technology said, this is great. We love it. We need to investigate and search out and do an audit of your servers. And we all kind of looked around the room and went, okay, but, you know, it's in the cloud. You know, we use that phrase. Well, I was a VP at Bell Atlantic, and, you know, that was all part of the process that they had to investigate. They had to see them. They had to make sure our security was appropriate. I'm like, I don't think Salesforce is going to allow you to see their servers, you know. Maybe we'll set up a dummy room and you can look at the computers and say, oh, look, computers, it's all good. But this was sort of that loss of control. Where's my data? And, you know, some of you may be here in the room, but many of you may work with these folks. We run into them all the time as we transition from campus-hosted solutions to the so-called in-the-cloud SaaS model, that there's still folks out there that need that box right next to them, right? Need that data. We even have clients that say, okay, that's fine. We'll put it up here in the cloud, but every night we want to put it down to our, we want to bring a copy of it down to our servers and put it on a tape. When I worked at LaSalle University, it was on the second floor, granted, but the second floor was where the information technology office was. And they had anybody know LaSalle University in Philadelphia? It's in Northwest Philadelphia. Not the safest place in the world. Not as bad as some other places in Philadelphia, but not the safest place. Broad and only. We had our IT staff on the second floor, and they would have all the servers, believe it or not, underneath the window of a 100-year-old building. I never quite understood that. Like, this building leaks all over the place. Why are you sticking the servers under? That's a whole other story. They would take the backup tapes and put them on the windowsill. So here are institutions that, okay, we're going to put everything up in the cloud, but I want control of that data. So I want to see it. I want to know I've got a copy of it right here. And I'm going to put it right there in the window so somebody could take it. Security. Yeah, so they wanted loss of control. I need control of it. And sometimes that's a very difficult thing for folks. Anybody deal with this? This is evil. This is progress. If you have people who are complacent about the institution, they're so comfortable in their position that they can't accept that. I can't accept any change to go on, whether it's big or small. They're complacent. They just feel like everything's just fine. This is where you're going to have the most problem in your organization. And this is what you always hear. We've always done it this way. How many of you deal with that? Okay. We don't want to do that. We've always done it this way, and it seems to work. Well, I believe we're at a tipping point right now, if not already past that tipping point, particularly in your undergraduate recruiting offices. Those folks are freaking out. The financial aid folks, whatever comes beyond freaking out, they're doing that. Okay. This last year, here's doom and gloom. I'll get doom and gloom over with and we'll move on, okay? This last year might not have been the worst year. It may be this year, okay? I have a 17-year-old senior, Julius. He's looking at colleges. He's a senior. He's doing the whole thing. Believe it or not, I'm on that other side of the table watching this whole thing happen. By the way, he does not want any of my advice, okay? 20-some years of doing this, he doesn't want any of my advice. Unless he's looking at a school, he goes, are they a client of yours? Yeah, Julius. Oh. Julius, do you want me to call them? No, I don't want you to do that. It's the only time he ever asked me for advice. So here he is. He's looking at this. Last year, you had folks who were already knee-deep in the process, hopefully had already saved up, hopefully had pulled out the money they were at least going to need for their first year so they could pay for that tuition this fall, last month starting. It's this next year. It's people making different decisions. And I will tell you, how many of you were at EDU Web Conference at the keynote? I just need a show of hands. Just a couple of you. Good. Okay. So I had a picture of Julius up here before, and I told you the story about Julius, so it'll only be a repeat for a couple of you. Julius is looking at University of Miami, University of Virginia, James Madison, University of Florida, and University of Central Florida. Very interesting selection of schools. Can you get the theme going on here? Julius likes warm weather. So does his mom. So they travel a lot to Florida. We're in Philadelphia, by the way, so it ain't warm there. And he plays baseball, so he's looking at all these schools. So you've got a school that's $40,000, $50,000 a year. Thankfully, the girls that were walking around campus the day he was there were not influencing him enough to say, I really want to go there. I won't tell you which school that is, you can guess. But University of Florida, University of Central Florida, James Madison, some great deals. And we're making that decision, not just that this would be the best place for him, but let's look for the best place that we're going to get a return on our investment. And that's the kind of discussion that's going on now in families. So we're at that tipping point, and we can't deal with we've always done it this way at the institution because families are doing it a different way now. 71% of families last year, students, but families, it's a joint decision, skipped over their dream school for economic reasons. 71%. There's a study by NACAC put out in June. Skipping over their dream school. So if you're a dream school for a lot of places, for a lot of students, they may be making different decisions. We had a big event at NACAC, the National Admissions Conference in Baltimore, last week. And we called a thing called I Think. It's a roundtable discussion of thought leaders and about 150 of your deans and directors of admission. And got them talking about this idea as to what is next, what's going to happen, what are the different decisions that people are making. And we had an institution that stood up and said they had a 67% tuition discount. Now, if any of you are familiar with tuition discounting, when I was in undergrad admissions way back when, if we were approaching 20%, we were in trouble. Or as a trustee of an institution, I won't tell you which one, wrote to me and said, we are in deep doo-doo. They were up in the 50%. Financial aid discount. So they could bring the students in. Oh, and by the way, this same institution also had the largest freshman class in history. And yet we're discounting at that rate. They can't afford them, right? You don't know where to put them either. I'll tell you some good stories. Providence College. Anybody hear from Providence College? I got to spend time at Providence College this summer at their staff retreat, their financial aid staff retreat. And the discussion surrounded, this was after I took a tour, discussion surrounded how are we going to deal with, you know, this idea that students who really are very effective, that we can enroll them when they show up on campus. And they all like to show up in the fall. So that started a whole discussion among the admissions staff. Well, you know, the problem is we're out there recruiting on the road, high school visits, college fairs. How do we go about dealing with all these students who want to come here? I said, well, how many interviews do you do in the fall? They said, well, we don't do any. We don't actually offer them. Well, what do you do? Sometimes we have information sessions. That's about it. I said, wait a minute. I just took two tours of your campus. I always do two tours when I go on campuses. And all the students told me was this is a very personal place, very accessible, very personal. And you're telling me you don't even allow for interviews? It's counter to your institution. They said, but we can't. We've always done it this way. We're on the road. We can't be here and there. So they're skipping recruiting to go out and recruit, which is more effective. We all know it's more effective when the students are on campus to recruit them than go out to a high school fair. The story went on. Providence College, the VP for enrollment, sat next to me, and he stopped the discussion. And he said, travel is off the table. Pretend we are not traveling at all this fall. Now what do you want to do? He won the X Award at NACAC last week. The X Award's an award we give out every year. And the award was for revolutionizing the recruiting process, embracing change. And he said, we know travel isn't as effective, so we need to just wipe it off and we'll put some back. But what's more effective is actually dealing with the students when they're here and embracing them. They now offer and encourage interviews for everybody, every day. They offer special sessions. And they did that in a two-day retreat. Just wipe the slate clean. Okay, it kind of helps that they're 20% down this year in enrollment, back against the wall. Sometimes that's what you have to do, right? It's Providence College. It's not you, it's me. I love that phrase. It's not you, it's me. It's all about me is really what I'm talking about here. Okay? This idea of making decisions internally instead of based on market conditions, market-driven information. So knowing what's going on in the market, and all too often, and some of you have heard this, and some of you even mentioned this earlier, is that we make decisions because this is who we are, this is the way we're always going to be, and not what does the market need or what does the market demand. I picked this one up, actually, Bob Johnson's newsletter. Anybody get Bob Johnson's newsletter every once in a while? He put one out this morning. It reminded me of University of Maine, and some of you have this. Ooh, okay, so I have a couple technology things. Web, okay. Web's not technology anymore, right? You guys are way past that anyway. Okay. This is their homepage. And what apparently has struck the attention of so many people here is an institution that put admissions front and foremost on their homepage. It's amazing. Think about your own. How many of you admissions is, let's say, at least 50% of your homepage? A couple of your schools. Central College? Xavier. Okay. Now, I say that because 80% of you here in the room are tuition-driven institutions. And if you're not putting admissions front and center in your homepage, why not? What's the opportunity that you're missing? Yeah. I could, but I don't like to make too many people mad. Yeah, I could make that argument.
Well, I barely strong. I feel like what
and I'll stop it right here. No, please. Yeah, no.
I feel like what they've said is prospective students don't really care about prospective students. They want to know what students.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I'll show you an example in a second here of one institution I think is doing a great job of that, but so are these folks. They've got students right up front. It is a little bit more about process and everything, and I'm more about stories. We'll talk more about that in a second. We have that. Institutions being all things to all people. Differentiation. They used to throw up here, differentiate or die. How many of you, when you go to your homepage, and I'm just going to focus on the homepage. Don't get me started on the other parts of your website. We could be here. That's a whole other three sessions. Just on your homepage, how does your institution differentiate themselves? Let's start first from your competitors, and I do not call them peer institutions. They're competitors. They're the enemy. They're evil. How do you differentiate yourself right from the homepage? That's a tough one, because all too often we end up doing everything just because, well, you know, so-and-so, our competitor, or we call them internally, our peer institution, just offered this program, so we're going to do that. When I was at LaSalle University, they wanted to start a master's in information technology. I said, great, okay, so what's going to make us different in this marketplace? They said, oh, well, LaSalle's the leader in IT. And I sat there in the room, and I didn't go to LaSalle, didn't go to LaSalle High School, I'm not even Catholic, but I sit in the room there, and I judged everything that went on around the room, and this market-based discussion was completely lacking. So I said, wait a minute. Have you guys ever heard of Drexel University? You ever heard of University of Pennsylvania? Temple. I don't even have, this was, by the way, 1996. I don't even have Windows on my desk, okay? I'm still running DOS. So, folks, we're not the IT. Being true to themselves, we call it authenticity. You've got to be authentic to your institution, and that takes a leader who understands what makes us different. Who are we? And sometimes it's being able to say, no, we are not this, we are not that. I put this out to all of you. By the way, I find that this audience in particular, maybe because I know some of you, and I've gone out drinking with some of you, that you tend to challenge the status quo as well. And I think that's good. Sometimes it has to come from the roots of the institution. Telling your organization and being in a discussion like that, when somebody wants to build whatever, and you're part of that campaign, and say, wait a minute, is this really us? Is this who this institution is? So a leader being able to say no. And for your sales team, I'll come back to that in a second, your admissions folks, what is their elevator pitch? What is that pitch? How can they describe your institution? We're a 4-year small liberal arts institution in suburban whatever city. Okay, that's about, 75% of the institutions in the U.S. Keep going. Keep it going as far as what makes your institution unique and how do you display that. Particularly, I'll talk to those folks here on the website. How do you display your elevator pitch on the web, which has become obviously a popular place for students to go and search for information about you? How's that story told on your web? So let's talk about stories. I'm a big believer of stories, and just brought up. Instead of coming and learning about the process, which is, I find, many institutional websites have, I'd rather see more stories. As a prospective student, they want to understand what is really interesting about this institution. Many of you might have seen me. I always throw this slide up. It's in every presentation I do. Mike Sexton, the Dean of Admissions at Lewis and Clark, said, stories, not stats, people, not programs. Because all too often, when you look at your web, you look at your publications, you look at all the things you put out there to try and influence students, we see programs, we see stats, we're 3,500 students on 104 bucolic acres, blah, 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 blah. It's just stats. It doesn't really say anything about the heart of the institution. And if anything we know about this generation, they want to get at who are you. They want to get away from the marketing speak. They want to know who the institution is. Stories, not stats, people, not programs. My alma mater, my undergrad alma mater, does a great job of this now. Big headline, big photo, only stories. In fact, they got rid of the view book. Now it's all about stories. It's called Faces. 8 students or faculty in each piece just telling their story, linked to their social network, telling stories. All those people, by the way, are involved in their on-campus programs. And, of course, they're linked on the website in this rotating graphic. All about stories, get the process out of the way. That's the easy stuff. Okay. I also find that most institutions, the most authentic thing about the institution are not the stats and not about the programs, but the people that go there or work there and the stories that they can share. So we need to share those more often. No surprise that blogs became popular, now social networks, and now they're going on Facebook. That's no surprise to all of you. But how well do you embrace it? It's another challenge to change. Something called false urgency. How many of you just feel like you're just running from one meeting to the next? Yeah? You're leaving meetings early to get to the next meeting? Leave them late and get even later to the next? Wow, I wish I would have known that one about 8 years ago when I was dealing with that. I would leave for a meeting early in the morning. I wouldn't even see Carol come in the morning. I'd see her about 3:00. And I walk in the office, and she's about ready to leave. I let her leave early because she'd come in early. And she'd say, well, it's nice seeing you. And I just remember that one day where that happened. And I just sat in my office, and it was empty. I was in what was called the fishbowl. So it was just me and my office and a glass window. So I was just watching people go back and forth. And I decided just to put my notebook down and said, what in the world are we doing here? I'm just going from one meeting to the next. Did I get anything accomplished today? And for me, that's incredibly frustrating. I'm a list person. I've got to write stuff down and cross it off a list. Okay, and if I don't cross anything off, man, that's the worst day in the world. If I only got half the things crossed off my list, either my list was way too long, and I'll beat myself up for that one, or I just wasn't able to get anything accomplished. And that's very frustrating for me. So false urgency. So what are some signs of false urgency? One is that you're running from meeting to meeting. The other is, well, there's a bunch of them here. Let me give you a few here to think about. You brought it up. All we're doing is hiring consultants, right? We got all these great people. Let's get out of their way and let them do their job, right? You have a difficult time scheduling important meetings on critical issues? That happens a lot. Now, there are tools so that we can schedule meetings. I know some of you use Outlook. I'm not a Microsoft fan, so I find everything that's not Microsoft. I've been using TimeBridge. Anybody use TimeBridge? TimeBridge is such a cool tool. It's sad because it is about scheduling meetings, but it allows you to share and let people decide when they can meet, and boom, suddenly it. Check it out if you want to know how to schedule. But if you're getting rid of meetings, you won't need TimeBridge. Do you have a committee on committees? Anybody have one of those? Yeah. And what did that committee do?
It talked about whether or not we were going to form more committees, what their charge was going to be, and all that.
One of my last institution was to create the committees.
Yeah.
They were given, here's the topic, and they were charged with creating the committee and put the members on. That's just messed up, I'll use a nice word. Oh, see, you got. Thank you for doing that. I've got this poor guy the whole day. Oh, see, I like that. A committee to get rid of. Yeah. See, the committee on committees should be recharged to get rid of committees. Okay. We already talked about market-based decisions, but if your decisions are inward-focused, you got some problems there, and failures of the past are stalling new initiatives. Does all this sound familiar? This is called false urgency. Now, if you're interested, I encourage you to pick up this book from John Cotter called A Sense of Urgency. It's a fantastic book. Really talks about how to get past some of these issues. Complacency and false urgency are the two things that are going to kill progress. So while you're trying to change whatever it may be that you're changing, you're going to have people that go along this curve. So there is a progress to it. That eventually, hopefully, you'll get past that middle point and people will go, wow, this actually is going to be beneficial not only to the organization, but maybe to me as well. Some people will drop off, by the way. Some of these folks, they'll just either drop off of the radar or they'll just drop off. Right.
So they did one study where they had a room full of college students and they gave only part of them the mug from the college with the logo on. And then the researcher said to everybody in the room, how much of those mugs were there? So if you didn't get a mug, how much would you pay for it? Those who got the mugs doubled the value of what they thought it was worth. Someone who didn't have a mug wanted to pay half.
Right.
So if you have something, you think it's more valuable.
Is a threat. Sure. Interesting. New Yorker, you said?
Yes.
I'll have to look that one up. Okay. It's going fast. We have 15 minutes, so we'll move this one along, right? Some solutions. This was thrown out actually last week at the conference I was speaking at, and I kind of like the point of this. Managers manage within paradigms. Leaders lead between paradigms. And if you believe that we're going between paradigms now, if you believe we are at or past the tipping point, are you a manager or a leader? It sounds like a sports thing, like a coach would say in the huddle, hey, are you a leader? Are you what are you going to be? Your title may be manager, but the title out of it. Are you leading this change in your part of your organization? Okay. Doesn't have to be big change. But are you leading? If you see that you need to have something adjusted to meet the conditions, are you leading between the paradigms? So let's bring it up to leadership. It may not have impacted all of you here, but I believe that now the solution to higher education is going to be leadership. It's going to be the presidency. It's going to be the boards. But I think we need, and you can do this in your own part of your institution. Do you have clear vision? Do you hire great people? Do you get out of their way? And that last one, do you hold them accountable? How many of you feel like you're held accountable at your institution? Yeah, a few, okay. I felt like no one could ever get fired at the institutions I worked at. They could do no wrong. And if you did wrong, it doesn't really matter. You just keep going, right? How many of you have annual evaluations? Okay. Okay, how many of those evaluations are effective? Okay. Wow, what a waste there. Okay. Hold them accountable. Okay, well, what can you do? It doesn't mean you don't have to worry about the whole institution. How about in your department? What can you do in your department to hold your people accountable? How many of you lead a staff? Okay, good. I guess I probably should ask that earlier. What can you do to hold them accountable? I think we already talked about this, death to the committee. I threw these up at the last time I did this. A committee is a group of people who individually can do nothing, but who as a group can meet and decide that nothing can be done. Or those that keep minutes and loses hours. So those are committees. That's what I think about committees. I also think this concept of shared governance. Do we have any faculty here in the room? Anybody that grew up as faculty? Okay. You're going to hate me on this one. I no offense to faculty, no offense to staff, no offense to administration. Leadership needs to embrace ideas, get everybody involved as much as possible, but I find that too many institutions, leaders cop out on this one in making a decision, in moving an organization forward. Shared governance is a great thing. It was formed as a great concept and still is valuable at an institution. It actually makes the institution very valuable. Corporations could learn from this, but institutions need to learn how to make decisions, and shared governance tends to be the cop-out. And so I did this, some of you might have seen this before. I went on Google Images and looked for images of college conference rooms, nice cozy conference rooms, very nice. How many of you have conference rooms like this where you meet? You're all sitting down enjoying these, very nice, okay? And if you've seen Target X's conference room, I don't know if you can see that back there, that's our conference room, cables and all, a mess, askew, but we move things around a lot. There are no chairs. Unless you come to our conference room, then we bring in stools, so we let you sit, okay? Because we want to make you feel comfortable. Now, I find, take the chairs away. It's amazing how fast meetings will go. It's amazing how those people that always need to say the same thing that has just been said two or three times earlier, that doesn't happen at all, right? Suddenly stop repeating the same thing that was said two or three times already. Take the chairs away. It's amazing. We do our monthly staff meeting. We have one tomorrow. It takes about an hour and a half. And we do it in the same room. We have to move the table a little bit out because we've got about 20 people, so it gets a little cramped in there. And you can see it about a half an hour later. You have people leaning up against the walls. You got some folks sitting on the windowsill, people leaning on the table. And suddenly we realize, okay, let's get the topic going. Keep things moving along. It's a little trick, but I find it works. The B word. What's the B word? Your business. Okay, I'm a big believer that higher education is a business. Okay, we got to stop thinking that it's something else. It is the business of education. Okay, so if we can all agree on that we are a business, we take in money, we have expenses, we hire people, we may or may not make up. Anybody here make a profit? By the way, the president, Dr. Papadakis, who just passed away this last year from Drexel University, I thought was just brilliant. He said, "What's the problem with a nonprofit having excess money in the end? Where did we ever get this idea that you can't have surplus?" Okay? You can. You got to just invest it back. Nothing wrong with that. Okay, so get comfortable with some new terms, some new words. Start using these. I remember when the term marketing was kind of taboo. And then suddenly we all got comfortable with marketing. Maybe because we were sick of other concepts that came around and we thought, let's just use marketing. Cost, return, investment, these are things that families are using now more than ever to determine whether they're going to go to your institution or not. And what's the S word?
Sales.
Thank you very much, Carlin. You're awesome. I'm a big believer your admissions people are salespeople. Anybody here work in admissions? Your folks that work in admissions, are you admissions people? Are you recruiters? Anybody think you're a salesperson? Okay. Yeah?
I'm a web guy.
You're a web guy. Okay. Okay, good. I just want to know whether I have, you know, people that like me or people that don't like me in the room. I just like to know. I'm not, it's not a self-confidence issue. I just don't want to be shot or anything. I believe admissions people need to realize that and they need to get out. And I think once you realize that, they'll do things differently. We got to get over this idea that sales is necessarily a bad word. We got over marketing. We get over business and get over sales. We don't have to call them salespeople. I get that. But this is what they do in admissions. This is what we do. That's sales. Okay. We even had this discussion last week at this roundtable discussion called I Think, where we discussed this idea that, well, we're really counselors. We're counseling. I said, well, you know what? I think a really good salesperson is also a really good counselor. Okay. If my product or service is not right for you, a good salesperson would say, my product's not right for you. That's a good salesperson. The problem is we got this guy in our minds, right? This is Morty. I bring Morty along to all my presentations now. It's not trustworthy, right? We don't trust this guy. He's going to sell us anything on the lot, even if we don't need it. That's not a good salesperson. Sorry, Morty. All right? Once we accept the fact they're salespeople, we're going to hire different people, we're going to train them differently, give them different tools. Oh, I didn't put the, I really wanted to put it in here, this out-of-office message that we got. We did a session on sales tips for admissions people. We did a webcast 2 weeks ago, half-hour session. We do these once a month. They're free. They're fun. You can go online and check them out if you want. We had about 600 people in this webcast watching this, and we had somebody write to us their out-of-office message. And it said something to the effect of, I should have put it in the slides, it was precious. Something to the effect of, I'm on the road recruiting, I have limited access to email, and when I get back, I'll have too many emails. So if you could email me again, that way I'll get your message. Are you kidding me? You're too busy recruiting to answer an email? Your admissions people are salespeople. Salespeople can't use out-of-office messages, period. Give them the tools they need. Give them the cell phones, give them the laptops, whatever it is, they are required to be on. They are on all the time. The only time they're off is when they're on vacation. And I'm a big believer of vacation, cut the grid, but they're on all the time. Set different goals and evaluate frequently. I'm going to just skip through here. I think you got to ask the question, what's your college in business for? Start asking that question in your own department. What are you doing that is core to the institution? And what are you doing that you could outsource? That you shouldn't be doing yourself. Somebody else has figured out how to do it better. By the way, I know I sit on that line. I'm a vendor, so I sit on that line. I'm not saying Target X. I'm talking about, think about what you do. What has somebody else figured out how to do it better? And let them do it. Do what you do best and outsource the rest. I know it's cute. I have a little video for you that I love. I'll share this with you.
Hi.
Is there a problem, sir?
Yes. A quick question about the final total.
Yes.
You see, yeah, we didn't budget for this.
Excuse me?
This was marked 1999.
Yeah.
Well, I've only got $7 set aside for this.
So what are we going to do today?
Well, I'd like the highlights.
Mm-hmm.
But for now, I can only pay for a trim.
Okay, so today we're only going to do the trim?
No, the highlights, but I can only pay for the trim.
I mean, how much of the taco stand was what?
About $12.
Yeah, right. About $12.
Sir, we're not the taco stand.
No, it was, I had beef, same thing as I had here.
You had the filet.
Yeah, cow.
Okay, let me make a phone call, see what I can do. Maybe I can get you $8.50. Can you do $8.50?
I'll pay for the highlights next time, but for now, I need you to just go ahead and throw them in.
So basically, you want me to work for free?
No, I don't want you to. I don't want you to work for free. It's just a test. That way, I can see if my husband likes it, and then you can roll the cost over until the next time I need color if he likes it.
I went through in line item some of the stuff that we would just remove.
I'm not making any money on this either. You got to help me out.
We got a discount bin.
I know. I've checked the discount bin. But I want this one. We can do this. This is not a challenge. This is an opportunity.
We tried with three entrees.
Oh, yes. You ordered three entrees, sir.
Well, we ordered, but it's ordering eating. Yeah, we ate one.
What's your name?
Todd.
Todd. You gotta work with me.
That one's $19.99.
Mike, come on. Let's do this.
Todd,
let's do this.
Dude.
Well, I can cover your hard costs, but that's really as far as I'm willing to go.
I'll give you $8.50 today. I'll come back next Tuesday. We're going to make it up on the next one. What do you say?
What?
Ah, excellent. We'll go ahead and we'll pay this time, but what we're going to need you to do is show us how you made it so we can do it on our own in-house from now on. You did? It's great dinner.
Okay, so do what you do best, outsource the rest, but treat your vendors nicely. Think of your vendors as partners. If your vendor's not a partner, then pick another vendor, okay? So I truly believe that you get the advantage of working with vendors, and there are the folks here that are exhibiting, and the hundreds of vendors that are available to you, they have that advantage of seeing across a number of institutions, okay, and treat them very well. I'm just about done here, so I'll take some questions, but I want you thinking about how can you move change forward. I really enjoyed spending this time with all of you folks. Any questions or comments? This is a quick 45 minutes. I'm going to be around for today, then I'll be leaving this afternoon. So if I see you around, if you got any thoughts, please let me know. Pick up a copy of the book in the back there, as well as, I believe, is there an evaluation that I should have handed out first beforehand and made you fill it out before we started? Yeah, all that kind of stuff. So thank you very much, folks. Thanks.